Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the devastation of the First World War shape the generation of men who fought it? When the first parties of British explorers set off for Mount Everest, they carried survival supplies and climbing gear, but also the emotional baggage of having survived a conflict that took the lives of nearly 900,000 of their country's soldiers. So how did all that pain and loss play into the drive to conquer the world's tallest mountain, and what did it take for those chosen to even make the attempt? Author Wade Davis is explorer in residence for National Geographic. He tells the story in his new book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Wade, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
How were the first English expeditions to Mount Everest conceived and organized?
Well, you know, it began as a sort of, in the late 19th century, as a kind of gesture of redemption for an empire of explorers who had famously lost the race for the North and South Poles. And Everest, of course, had emerged as sort of the third pole, the ultimate quest. And, of course, because it was within the orbit of the British Raj, it was really seen as British terrain. But if the quest before the war was sort of one for imperial redemption, in the wake of the war, it really became a gesture of regeneration for an entire empire nation bled white by the war. And from the very start, the effort to climb Everest was completely entwined with sort of British imperial policy, permission to climb it originally, to go through Tibet, to even find the mountain, was actually an arms deal made with the Dalai Lama in an attempt to sort of shore up the Tibetans against the Chinese. And so from the very, very start, Everest was part of that kind of imperial thrust, but it shifted because of the agonies of the war. You know, Chris, I first became interested in this story quite serendipitously in the spring of 1996 when I traveled with a close friend of mine, Daniel Taylor, 4,000 miles from Chengdu in western China through southeastern Tibet to Lhasa and on to Kathmandu, and we were part of an ecological survey, and we happened to pass the mountain in the spring where the debacle happened, that John Krakauer so powerfully wrote about in his book Into Thin Air. And Daniel, who was with me, was the son and grandson of medical missionaries, and he was particularly disturbed at the way in which the commercialization of the mountain had gotten to the point where people were dying so unnecessarily. And this was not the Everest of his imaginings, because, of course, Daniel was raised in the Himalaya, and he was raised on stories of these extraordinary early Brits. And, in fact, Daniel's dad was a very close friend of Howard Somerville, who was climbing with Mallory in 1922 and 1924. And that was the Everest of Daniel's imaginings. And by chance, the very next fall, Daniel and I were back on the east face of Everest in the legendary Gama Valley, beneath the Kanchen face, where you stand on ground higher than anything in North America, and yet you're looking up at 2 vertical miles of ice. And Daniel, in his inimitable way, began to speak of these Englishmen in tweeds who read Shakespeare to each other in the snow at 23,000 feet, and I was completely enchanted. And I came back, and I knew, of course, that entire generation of men, just because of their class, their education, they had all gone through Oxford and Cambridge, and because of the circumstances of the early part of the 20th century, I knew they had all gone through the horror of the war. And I was never really interested in whether George Mallory reached the top before he died. And just for those in the audience who aren't familiar with the sort of the basic story, you know, the British in 1921 launched a reconnaissance in which they literally had to walk 400 miles off the map just to find the base of Mount Everest, which had never been approached by Europeans at close quarters. And then in 1922 and 24, having found the doorway to the mountain, they launched 2 attempts to climb it. And that the climax of that effort, of course, was June 8, 1924, when George Mallory, age 37, the most famous climber in the world at that point, along with a young companion of 22, Sandy Irvin, a great athlete from Oxford who had never really been on a mountain before, were famously seen 2 dots cresting a northeast ridge by Noah Waddell, a brilliant climber and support, cresting the ridge as they moved hard toward the summit. And then, of course, the mist rolled in and enveloped their memory in myth, and they were never seen alive again. again. And the question has always been, did they get to the top before they died? But as I said, Chris, I wasn't that interested in that per se. What I wanted to know was, what was the spirit that drew them on? And knowing what I had done of that, I did of that generation, my thought was not that they were cavalier about death, and they certainly didn't court their end. I mean, George Mallory at that point was a beloved father of three wonderful kids, and he had a beautiful wife. But rather, they had seen so much of death in the trenches that it had no hold on them. There was nothing more that death could teach them except their own. And so as they moved toward the summit, life in some sense mattered less than the moments of being alive. And that was the theme that I explored over 12 years of doing the research for this book. And to do so, what I did is I took the 26 men who participated in those three expeditions, and I traced back their lives through every single day of the First World War from 1914 to 1918. And as I had anticipated, they had really truly gone through a twilight memory of hell.
Yeah, essentially, in 1921 through 1924, the entire population of young men in Britain was made up of those who had managed to survive the First World War. So in addition to being athletes and explorers, this was a party of combat veterans still dealing with not only their...
Chris, I mean, Jack Hazard, who famously reached the top of the North Col in 1924, did so with open bleeding wounds beneath his climbing tunic, wounds from the Somme that would never heal. You know, we forget as Americans, I think, that, you know, we tend to focus on the Second World War as sort of the key war of the 20th century. But, of course, we forget that the First and the Second were, as Churchill famously said, one and the same, a 30 years war. Churchill famously said, never was there a war less necessary to fight than the First or more essential to win than the Second. And it's hard, perhaps, for Americans to understand, because the First, in a sense, wasn't our war. But what our grandparents, I'm Canadian, and what they went through in this war, one of the things that astonished me was how, you know, it's famously said at the battles of the Somme, the greatest disaster in the history of British arms, and Passchendaele, which came later in 1917, which was even a more terrible battle. A battle in which, incidentally, the British would lose 400,000 men to advance the line 5 miles, a battle that left 92,000 British boys so severely disfigured on the battlefield that they could not be identified, another 40,000 boys that simply evaporated, shattered by shell fire, a spray of red mist across the mud of Flanders. We forget, you know, it was famously said of both those battles that the British Army lacked the clerk power to tabulate the dead. Well, if that was true, they kept records of just about everything else. I mean, that war was so thoroughly chronicled that one almost wonders how the men found time to fight. And that, together with the fact that the British zone of operations was hauntingly small. At no point was the British front longer than 125 miles. For much of the war, it was as short as 85 miles. And yet, if you can imagine, Chris, behind that front, the British built 6,000 miles of trenches, 6,000 miles of railroad. The Ypres salient, around the old medieval cloth town of Ypres in Belgium, which was an area of land you could walk around in a long day or two, 4 miles by 12 miles, within that cauldron of death, 1.7 million boys of both sides would die. And because the frontage was so short, the zone of operations so small, roughly the size of the county of Lincolnshire in England, and yet because millions of men moved through, and because after the war there was this cathartic outpouring of literature, diaries, poetry, prose, journals, letters to loved ones, and memoirs, and because of that, every single corner of that battlefield was chronicled at every single point in the war by multiple voices. You know, the bombastic boasts of a Yorkshire sergeant or the haunting cries of a subaltern broken in shell shock. And so it was astonishing. You could find out, as I did, where each of these men were every single day of the war, and not only that, to know what had happened to them. Now, of the 26 men who went to Everest, six missed the war. Sandy Irvin was famously too young. A couple of them were too old. Tom Longstaff set out the war in India. Beetham was a schoolmaster and exempted from service. And Guy Bullock was a diplomat. But the other 20 most assuredly did see the war. And let me share one anecdote that perhaps will really allow you to sort of see what I mean about the impact of the war on these men. I mean, when I first had this idea, for example, Chris, there were individuals who said, wait a minute, you know, we've looked into it, the war. They never spoke about the war. And, of course, no one spoke about the war. T.E. Lawrence of Arabia fame and Robert Graves, the poet warrior, who's left for dead on the battlefield of the Somme, shrapnel having torn his entire lungs apart with multiple wounds, who was incidentally was a student of George Mallory at Charterhouse, and Mallory was Graves' best man at his wedding. But Robert Graves and T. Lawrence famously made a deal never to talk about the war. It was never spoken about, but never forgotten. Now, one of the great discoveries I made in doing this research over 12 years is that all Everest historians have said that in 1921, on the reconnaissance, there was only one journal kept by Mallory's friend and climbing partner from his school at Winchester, Guy Bullock, who, as I said, was in the diplomatic service. And this was a kind of a curt journal that was published in 1962 by the Alpine Club. Mallory is often referred to as if he kept a journal. He never kept a journal. He wrote letters to his beloved wife that are at Magdalen College. The head of the expedition, a remarkable guy, Charles Howard Bury, wrote his dispatches to the London Times, but he did not keep a daily log in the same sense. But I found the unsung hero of Everest turned out to be a Canadian. Now, Mallory famously, for reasons I never understood, hated Canadians. Now, I didn't, Chris, hold that against him much. But the man who actually found the route to the mountain, the key to the East Rongbuk Glacier, the route to the North Col that every climber climbing the mountain from Tibet from the north side to this day takes, was not the legendary George Mallory. It was an obscure Canadian surveyor, Oliver Wheeler, seconded to the expedition from the Survey of the India at the time in 1921 with the mission to get closer to the mountain than anyone else and to use a new photographic survey technique to literally map the faces of the inner massif. Oliver Wheeler would spend more time closer to the mountain, exposed to the wrath of the wind, the agony of the heights, than any other man. And, amazingly enough, Chris, and this is one of the great joys of doing this kind of research, guess what? I found his son, age 77, living in Vancouver, not five doors from the house where my parents brought me home from the hospital when I was a baby boy. And I went to see Mr. Wheeler, and after the course of this long, wonderful afternoon, suddenly we discovered that he had gone to the same boarding school as my father, and I had climbed some of the same mountains that he had surveyed for the Geological Survey of Canada. And suddenly he pulls from his shelf two treasures, thick journals kept by his father in 1922 as he walked across Tibet to find Everest with Mallory. These were a treasure trove. Now, on that approach march, and this is where it gets really interesting, on that approach march in 21, a very famous high-altitude physiologist by the name of Arthur Kellis, 56 years old, too old for Everest, literally died, succumbed to exhaustion, and was buried by a great Tibetan fortress by the name of Kampazong. In Wheeler's journals, on the morning of that burial of that companion, this is what the journal says. Well, they buried the old boy in the morning. Terribly sorry to have missed it, but I do hate funerals. Now, I'll tell you after the break why he hated funerals.
Wade Davis is my guest. He's National Geographic Explorer in Residence and author of the new book, Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. If you'd like to ask a question, we have phone lines open now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and National Geographic Explorer-in-Residence Wade Davis. His new book is called Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. And Wade, before the break, you were telling us about the things you had discovered in Oliver Wheeler's journals.
Yes, I mean, you know, as I mentioned, you know, Oliver Wheeler was on with Mallory as they marched across Everest in 1921, 400 miles just to find the base of the mountain. And en route, this famous high-altitude physiologist, Arthur Kellis, just died of exhaustion and was buried. And in the journal, Wheeler basically says that his one entry that day is, well, they buried the old boy in the morning, thought it was going to be the afternoon, terribly sorry to have missed it, but I do hate funerals. Well, I mean, Chris, how do you miss the interment of one of your six men on your expedition that you're walking across Tibet for 8 weeks with, you know? Obviously, something else was going on, and of course it was, and I knew the answer would be found on the Western Front. Wheeler was born to be a soldier. He was an officer in the Indian Army, the 7th Merd Division, sailed for France at the outbreak of hostilities. And we forget that within 2 months of the outbreak of the war, the British regular army, the four divisions that they were able to send across the channel as a British expeditionary force, was utterly annihilated. And the entire British sector of the front was held by the Canadians in the north and the Indian Army in the south. Now, by this point, November 1914, the topography of Armageddon had come into place, and the trench lines reached to the coast from the Swiss border. Both sides were beginning to sap each other, putting out trenches that perpendicular to the main trench line so you could get close to the enemy line and harass it. It came to the attention of Wheeler's command that the Germans had put two saps within 30 feet of their front line, and he was given the order on a rainy, black November night to go over the top and not only bury those enemy saps, but to do so in a way that would dissuade the Germans from ever doing it again. With 125 men, he goes over the top. All hell breaks loose, artillery, machine gun fire, very lights illuminating the sky, and they get to the saps and to discover that to their horror, they're filled with German lads about to attack them. The result is the most horrific hand-to-hand combat you can imagine. Eyes gouged out, noses bitten off, heads crushed by handmade clubs. Eventually, the Germans are pushed back by the Indians, but not before the entire sap is lying three bodies deep, chest to chest, of dying boys of both sides, flaying, as Wheeler recalled, like trout in my crail. He tried to get the wounded out of his own side to the extent that he could, but in the chaos of the battle, he ultimately had to bury those boys alive. And so when he says 4 years later on Everest, I do hate funerals, that's what he's talking about. And this is something that, you know, it's worth just thinking back to this war. You know, at the outbreak of that war, a man had to stand 5'8" to enlist in the British Army. Within 2 months, men as short as 5'2" were eagerly recruited to the slaughter. Cremation was unknown before the war as a way of dealing with the dead, but in the wake of the war, it became the preferred form of burial for countless tens of thousands who, for 4 years and 4 months, had literally lived within the corpse field of rotting flesh of no man's land and the Western Front. Plastic surgery was born of the war and the need to try to repair the shell-scarred faces of young boys who for the rest of their lives would go about their lives, their faces covered in plastic masks that they could only remove at these special holiday weekend camps where they could go and allow the wind to touch their gargoyle features without fear of shame or humiliation. The regular British Army required 2,500 shovels for the entire empire. In the mud of Flanders, 10 million would be required, and 25,000 coal miners spent the entire war underground, tunneling beneath the enemy trenches to detonate these massive charges of TNT that blasted with reverberation that could be heard and felt on Hampstead Heath in London. Each month, the British Army alone required 10,000 new junior officers each month to replace the wounded and the dead. So schools like Uppingham Academy, Charterhouse, where Mallory taught, Winchester, Eton, Harrow, literally graduated their senior and sometimes their junior classes, not to Oxbridge or Oxford and Cambridge or to Edinburgh, the University of London, but directly to the Western Front, where many would perish. And so by the end of the war, you know, you had 2.5 million wounded, nearly a million dead in Britain alone. bones, 60,000 men without sight, 65,000 who never came back from the twilight hell of shell shock. And in the wake of the war, you know, even as Britain emerged on paper in better shape than ever, you know, its army was intact, the navy was intact, its own countryside hadn't been ravaged, but economically and psychologically and spiritually, it was destroyed. And women often spoke about it in the metaphor of dance. Nancy Cooper famously said, by the end of 1916, every boy I'd ever danced with was dead.
So clearly, Wade, there was a great value to the people who had experienced this in calling on their courage for something other than war, which makes, I think, sense to us. I want to step back here for just a minute and talk about even the name Everest. What made the British decide that this mountain in the Himalayas needed an English name?
Well, that's actually a very good question. I mean, the discovery of, when I said the very beginning of our conversation that, you know, Everest was always sort of enmeshed in the British imperial effort, I mean quite literally so. You know, the whole idea of India was in some sense a British invention. I mean, the entire ability for the British to rule that subcontinent was astonishing. You know, there were never more than 1,300 men in the Indian civil service, dominating a fifth of humanity. I mean, Lord Curzon famously remarked there wasn't a single Indian in the Indian civil service because in the entire subcontinent there wasn't a man capable of the job. And so if mercantile zeal and military repression and the co-optation of local elites played a role in the maintenance of the Raj, what really held it together was the sheer gall of the effort, the sheer audacity of a small island nation that never set out to rule the world, but did so with such flair. And in a sense, maps were the key to the very notion of India, because it was the maps that codified the country, created the idea of India, which didn't really exist as a single entity, and at the same time provided the rationale for occupation. So it shouldn't surprise us that the greatest scientific experiment of the 19th century, the experiment that led to the discovery of the highest mountain in the world, was literally the measurement of India. Because, you see, geographers in the 19th century knew that the Earth was not a perfect sphere, but the degree of the distortion was not known, and it was of critical importance to navigation. And so beginning in 1806, the British embarked on the great experiment known as the Great Trigonometrical Survey, and this implied the literal measurement of a single arc of longitude across the entire length of that continent, and to measure that arc through triangulation implied marching the finest scientific instruments of the 19th century, 1,000-pound brass theodolites, literally mile by mile across a continent. And such was the wizardry of the mathematics and the genius of differential calculus that when they reached the Himalaya, they could literally look across the ranges and measure the heights of mountains with an extraordinary accuracy, so that the estimates that came out in 1857, 1858 were roughly 30 feet off what we measure Everest today by modern aids such as GPS. And at that time, the sense was that all mountains should bear local names, but there was a strong push to name Everest, the biggest mountain in the world, after George Everest, who had been the head of the Survey of India that had led this incredible scientific experiment. And he was a very nasty man, liked by nobody, but it was his sheer will and audacity that had sort of led this adventure that eventually consumed almost a century. And it's one of the ironies of history that even though he did not want the mountain named after him, it would be named after him and yet mispronounced for all time, because his actual family name was pronounced Everest, not Everest. But you see, it wasn't Everest that caught people's attention as much as the land that lay beyond Everest. And there was a great concern then that as the British Empire had been expanding on sea, the Russian Empire had been expanding on land to the tune of 55 square miles a day, every day through the 19th century. So this was the genesis of this great conflict known as the Great Game to the British, or the Tournament of Shadows to the Russians. And what was really driving the British crazy is that they had no way to have any diplomatic engagement with Tibet, even though the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, was but 250 miles away from Darjeeling, a major agricultural center in the Raj. It exported tea to every hamlet in England. And so Lord Curzon, who famously said, you know, frontiers are the razor's edge upon which the fate of empires rise and fall, couldn't stand the fact that he had no way to communicate with Lhasa. So in the end, he marched his young husband's army into Lhasa, break the virginity, as they put it, of this mystical capital, unknown capital of Tibet, and suddenly everybody is crestfallen. And on the way back, young husband simply looks over to the south and sees the shining summit of Everest scoring the heavens, and Everest sort of becomes a new focus of all imperial desire. So that's how it sort of stood behind before the war. Then in the wake of the war, as Tom Longstaff famously said, the supply of climbers is not what it once was before the war. And so the men that were sent out were all survivors of the war, all incredible characters. You know, you see these photographs of them in their tweeds and their ties and their vests and so on. They look almost mousy. But they were the most extraordinary men. You know, Sandy Wollaston, for example, the naturalist in 1921, he at one point in his early life responded to an advertisement in the London Times that gave him 24 hours to get to the English Channel. He then traveled 3 months just to catch up with a botanical expedition in the Mountains of the Moon in Uganda, spent 9 months in the jungle, and when it came time to go home, he thought, what the heck, why should I go back the same way? He walked from the source of the Congo to the mouth. A year later, he was with 125 Dayaks he bought in Borneo and a bunch of Japanese prisoners and a bunch of Englishmen thrashing their way through the jungles of New Guinea, trying to get to the top of the highest mountain of New Guinea. Everybody died, and he was left with one survivor and one other Englishman dying of malaria on a cot. And as they were eating their proper English dinner service at these boxes, you know, with proper manners and all, the river was literally rising beneath their seats and drowning them. And as Wollaston said in his journal, at least we had no trouble washing up that night.
Wait, you mentioned tweeds, and I want to go back to that for a minute, because it's really as dangerous and demanding and difficult as Everest is to climb today, it's almost impossible to imagine doing this without,
well, part of the cliche, Chris, is that these men were terribly under-equipped. I mean, they really weren't. I mean, they had the best that technology could provide in that era. I mean, George Finch, who was on the 1922 expedition and set the height record that season of 27,600 feet, famously invented the eiderdown jacket for Everest. They knew about layering. They had silk, they had wool, and they had anoraks and so on. Probably the weakest part of their equipment were their leather boots with the nailed soles that can conduct the cold. But, you know, the thing about Everest is that it's not a technically challenging mountain like K2. It's an ordeal. You know, one's chances of climbing Everest really depend on conditions, one's own acclimatization, the character of the wind, the what the weather is doing that day. As Howard Bury famously remarked about Everest, it was the one place in the world he'd ever been where the top half of your body could be suffering from sunstroke while the bottom half was suffering from frostbite.
So what kinds of technological advances did they make, even in terms of their gear and their clothing, on those 1920s?
Oxygen. You know, it had been discovered during the war. And again, this link to British imperial efforts. During the war, it had been discovered. You just think what happened to the airplane during the war. It went from barely being an instrument of war to being a critical instrument of war. And a big part of being able to do that was that they discovered that with supplemental oxygen, pilots could fly and operate at high elevation, at high altitude. And so they knew oxygen was a great aid. And so one of the big debates on the expeditions of the 1920s was whether or not oxygen was sporting or not. And there was one side of so-called purists, mostly men in London who never climbed higher than their desks, who thought it was unsporting, whereas those more scientifically inclined, like Howard Somerville and George Finch himself, felt that using oxygen as a supplemental aid was no different in kind than seeking out the best possible pair of boots you could find. But the argument was a bit more complicated than that because there were great unknowns. Nobody knew, for example, what would happen if someone using supplemental oxygen at 27,000 feet suddenly did not have a supply of it. And that problem was solved in an emergency situation where George Finch in 22 literally saved Jeffrey Bruce's life when the apparatus failed and Bruce was about to fall off 10,000 feet to the Rongbuk Glacier. And he saved him, and in doing so realized that they could suddenly breathe again, even if you lost supplemental oxygen. So, you know, there are any number of technical developments, but some of the key things they did not have were, for example, front toe pointed crampons. So when Mallory famously, from the West Rombuk Glacier, peered down into Nepal, and remember, Nepal was closed geopolitically at that time, that wouldn't have kept Mallory from crossing that border, but he looked down on what eventually became the successful route that Hillary climbed in 1953 with Tenzin Norgay, and what intimidated Mallory there was, of course, the steep slope of the Western Khum that today climbers go up either in steps cut by Sherpa or with front-toed crampons, and that wasn't available to them. And so there were some impediments, but these were extraordinary climbers, and to know that they got as high as they did is simply extraordinary.
What role did the locals play in assisting these early missions?
Well, that's another really great question. You know, you asked about the origins of the name of Everest, and there's a lot of what I call hippie ethnography about Everest. You know, you hear that it's called Shoma Lungma, goddess mother of the world. It's just complete fabrication. There's no sort of ethnographic justification for that. One of the things I really tried to do in the research for the book was to tell the story as well from the Tibetan side of things. And so, for example, in the expeditions in the 20s, and the men passed, as they approached Everest from the north, they went up the Rongbuk Glacier, and they encountered the Rongbuk Glacier, which they thought had been there since the dawn of time. They had a series of very fascinating interactions with the lama of that monastery, a man called Zatar Rinpoche. And in fact, the monastery there became kind of a locus of their aspirations, and wanting to know more about that, I did a number of things. First of all,
let me jump in here because we're going to take a quick break. You can tell us about those after.
Sure,
my guest is author Wade Davis. He is National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and his new book is called Into the Silence: The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Wade Davis, whose new book is called Into the Silence: The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Wade, you were talking about the relationship between the British explorers and the Tibetans, who essentially thought the British were insane for wanting to climb this mountain.
Well, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, of course, the whole purpose of this precious incarnation is to follow the fourth of the noble truths, which is the contemplative practice that, if pursued, will allow you to follow a roadmap to enlightenment. And so the idea of thrusting yourself deliberately into a zone of death where oxygen deprivation alone obliterates consciousness is, for the Buddhist, about the stupidest thing you could ever do. And they had no interest in climbing mountains. Now, Everest itself was not a sacred mountain. In fact, one of the reasons the Sherpas were not were willing to go up it is that it had been, the deities of the mountain had been tamed by Guru Rinpoche when he first transmitted Buddhism to Tibet. And so, in order to get this perspective of how the Tibetans really viewed the British, I did a couple of things. First of all, every great lama would keep a spiritual autobiography, a Namtar, and I knew the one that Zatar Rinpoche, who was the charismatic lama of Rongbuk that the British met in 22 and 24 and 21, he was on a retreat. I knew it had never been translated, so I found a copy of it somehow and had it translated by monk scholars in Kathmandu. And then also I knew that to know what the monastery was like in 1921, all I really had to do was live in the monastery Zatru Rinpoche's spiritual heir, a man called Trisik Rinpoche, who, when the Tibetans were forced to flee across the Nangpala, the 23,000-foot pass to the west of Everest, after the takeover by the Maoist, Trisik Rinpoche reestablished, in effect, the Rongbuk Monastery at a place called Tupten Sholing. So I spent many weeks there, knowing full well that to be in the presence of Trisik Rinpoche from a Tibetan perspective was literally to be in the presence of Zatru Rinpoche, and indeed the ritual activities that I would witness in the weeks and indeed months I was at that monastery were exactly those that the British would have seen, because the liturgical cycle doesn't vary year to year. And so when John Knoll, the photographer in 22 and 24, famously photographed what he called the devil dances, well, that was a very interesting ritual called the Manirimdu, an 18-day ceremony that commemorates the spread of Buddhism across the Himalaya by Guru Rinpoche. And so to be in Tupten Sholing was literally to be in the presence of Zatru Rinpoche. And at the same time, I knew that Everest itself was not a sacred mountain, but I knew that Guru Rinpoche, in this sort of metaphysical dance of his across the Himalaya, he had famously sewed treasures, as they're called, tertons, which were guidebooks to illumination, which both existed in physical and metaphysical space, and that he had established a series of spiritual refugia that, again, were both geographical locales and metaphysical destinations. And this really is the origin of the idea of Shangri-La. And along the flanks of Everest, particularly to the east, is one of the hidden valleys known as the Hidden Valley of Artemisia and Kembelun. And the Buddhist idea is that the entire valley is a radiant Buddha field, a living mandala that's anchored by the sacred mountains, and that just merely to enter the valley is to be transformed and develop ever greater levels of loving compassion and so on. And so what was interesting about this was not the idea that Everest was sacred, but that rather all the time the British were walking in the environs of Everest, they were indeed, although they didn't know it, walking through mystic space. And there were these wonderful moments, Chris. For example, Charles Howard Bury was one of my favorite characters, a leader of the 1921 reconnaissance. He was a man not destined to be a soldier, but he became a soldier. But as a young man, he snuck into tent. He was always drawn to the mystical. He read Krishnamurti and Kiel Gibran. He once anointed his body with scented oils and naked walked the length of the Ganges. He famously killed a man-eating tiger that had run off and eaten 21 holy men. He, in time, would speak 27 Asiatic and European languages fluently, an extraordinary character. But during the war, he was, in fact, one of his great things, just before the war, he picked up a little baby bear in the mountains of heaven in Central Asia. He took it home to his estate in Belvedere in Ireland, and as bears do, Agu began to be a bigger bear. Before he knew it, he had a 9-foot Asiatic bear living with him, and his favorite form of exercise was to wrestle with the bear beneath the arbor of his mansion. But during the war, he fought in every horrific engagement, and his spirit only broke once, and that was at a place called Devil's Wood, where that afternoon the British had lost 4,000 boys. And that night he was given the order to dig a communication trench, and he and his men were out in the darkness digging when they suddenly realized they weren't digging through the salt, the chalk soils of Picardy. They were digging through rotten flesh, digging through cadavers piled 6 feet deep. And he almost went mad. And then flash forward to 1921, he's on his pony, moving toward their destination, a town of Tingri that's going to be their base. Tingri that gets its name because when the Buddha dispatched Guru Rinpoche to spread the Dharma in Tibet, he famously picked up a stone that was a perfect sphere, and he flung it across the Himalaya, and it landed with a single harmonic note that reverberated through the wilderness, through the universe. And Guru Rinpoche was said to go find that spot and begin the transmission of the Dharma to Tibet. Well, Tingri was where it landed. And as he was approaching Tingri, Howard Bury saw this strange form on the road, sort of standing and falling with the consistency of a metronome. As he got closer, he realized it was a Mongolian Buddhist pilgrim moving one body length at a time in ritual prostration up and down, 1,500 miles from Lhasa to Kathmandu. And as his pony clip-clopped past the pilgrim, he could hear the sound of the man's hands in the dirt of the road, And he it was a stunning affirmation of religious possibility. He suddenly looked over his shoulder to the left, and for the first time in his life, he saw the summit of Everest scoring the skyline to the south. And so it was this incredibly dramatic moment of both religious affirmation and the kind of extraordinary clarion call of that mountain to these men who had endured so much in the war.
Well, Wade, we only have about 7 minutes left, so I want to make sure that we get to this before, and forgive me for having to sort of fast forward, but
sure.
In 1999, a body was discovered that was confirmed to belong to George Mallory. Sandy Irvin's body is still missing. What did we learn from the physical evidence left behind?
Well, this is an extraordinary story. A good friend of mine, Conrad Anker, who's a wonderful guy and one of the finest climbers in the world today, was part of a team that deliberately set out to see if they could find Mallory's body on the mountain. And really, it was Conrad's intuition, together with the good fortune that there had been very little snow on the mountain, that led him, as he drifted across the mountain that has killed one person for every 10 that have reached the top. I mean, the mountain is today littered with corpses. And he suddenly saw this white color that was not snow, and it was like an Elgin marble, and it turned out to be the back of George Mallory. And the question always had been, with Mallory and Irvin on that fateful day of June 8th, 1924, is that once you get to the Northeast Ridge, there were really two impediments. They were called the first and second step, both bluffs of rock. The first one, not that difficult to turn, and we know that Mallory and Irvin got to at least the base of that because one of their oxygen bottles was found. The question became, what happened at the second step? Now, the second step involves a pitch of rock about 120 feet sheer, with exposures on both sides of roughly 10,000 feet down to the Kanchum face on one side of the mountain, the Rongbuk Glacier, the Kanchum Glacier on one side of the mountain, the Rongbuk Glacier on the other. And the question has always been, could Mallory have free climbed the second step? And even more importantly, could Sandy Irvin have done it? Because we know that at least most people would have believed that Mallory would never leave young Sandy behind. So when Mallory's body was found, it was intriguing, but nothing definitive was found on it to prove one way or another. What was important is that there was a frayed rope attached to the body, which clearly showed that both men had been tied together at the time of their accident. Did that mean that they fell together? Did it mean that the broke rope, as Irvin was doing a belay down the yellow band? Nobody quite knows, but the body, the condition of the body suggests very strongly that they were on their way down and had descended quite a ways. And sadly, one of the tragedies is it turns out that the body came to rest not 300 meters from one of the advanced camps where they might have found rescue. The enticing thing is nothing found on the body showed one way or another anything definitive. And, of course, the reason the body was to some extent almost ravaged by those who found it, which was very controversial, I shouldn't say ravaged, but certainly their treatment of the body suggested that their priority was trying to find the camera, because it was known that Howard Somerville had lent his pocket Kodak camera to Sandy Irvin on the eve of the last attempt. Technicians at Kodak had affirmed that with the cold, it was quite likely that the film, if it could be found, could still be processed, and hopefully this would reveal that they had reached or not reached the summit. The camera was not found on Mallory, and of course, as you mentioned, Irvin's body has yet to be found, and probably is not going to be found, would be my guess. When we look at the actual challenge of getting up the second step, I think most lines of logic would suggest that they couldn't have done it, in part because we know they began their final climb severely depleted. They had lost their stove. They didn't have the means to melt water. Dehydration is a curse on the mountain. We know that Sandy Irvin was suffering from terrible sun blistering, sunburn on his face. We know that they didn't have crampons that they could use at that elevation, and yet when Conrad replicated the route to the summit, he found crampons essential. Modern-day climbers, for example, always come down off that second step by using a rope belay from a prominent boulder. In Mallory's day, they had ropes that were neither strong enough nor long enough to do that belay. So even if they had surmounted the second step, it's hard to know how they would have been able to get down in any kind of safe manner. I think all kinds of evidence suggests pretty clearly that it's unlikely they went beyond the second step, and they probably turned around at that point, came down, and had a dreadful accident. And don't forget that Mallory had already come close to death on no fewer than three or even four moments on that mountain on those three expeditions. However, there is one enticing and wonderful possibility, and that is that had the snows that battered that expedition in 1924, forcing Colonel Teddy Norton, who was the head of the expedition, to retreat not once but three times from even the base of the North Col, let alone the summit of the North Col, had those snows accumulated on the northeast ridge, as they certainly did further down the mountain, it's not inconceivable that a cone of snow could have formed that, if it didn't completely obscure the second step, it could have formed a ramp sufficiently large, as indeed did occur in the fall of 1985, in which case Mallory and Irvin would have simply had to walk up that ramp of snow, and they would have been able to do so at the very speed that Noah Odell, who famously saw them last alive, famously reported. And had that been the case, had George Mallory been able to get to the top of the second step, nothing would have kept him from the top of the mountain, because for that generation, as I said earlier, life mattered less than the moments of being alive. And one of the most powerful sort of comments that was made once it was known that George and Sandy were dead was made by one of the climbers as he looked back out over the scene of the entire drama as they left the Roanoke Valley for the last time. And he looked out onto that valley, and he basically said that, knowing what he knew, it was not hard to understand that for Mallory, as for all men, the price of life is death. And as long as the payment is made promptly, it doesn't matter where it's made. Up there in the mountain are two cold forms. Yesterday, they lived with all the excitement of being alive, you know. And then the key line was this: and today they are gone without ever knowing the possibility of decay. Could any man wish for a better fate? And that ties you right back to the experience on the Western Front. And again, there was a great letter written by Billy Grenville the day before he died in a useless attack in the Ypres salient a month after his own brother Julian had been mortally wounded in that same sector of the front. He tried to explain to his father what it had been like to be at the front, and he said, "Father, out here, death is but a frail barrier that men cross smiling and gallant every day."
You know what? I'm so sorry, Wade. I think we're going to have to leave it there because we are completely out of time.
That's a good point to end it.
Absolutely. The new book by Wade Davis is called Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory, and the Conquest of Everest. Thank you so much for joining us for the hour.
My pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.